And the intention was to walk along, do another podcast out on the field. But I'm not unabashed. Is that the right word? I can't walk along and do this thing without worrying how I'm being perceived by people around me. So like a little Rottweiler looking bloke comes up to me, I have to pause the recording because I don't want to have to go, "I'm doing it for my art project, sir. I'm doing it for my art project. I'm doing it for art, sir." You know, as you're walking along with a recorder, if he's looking like a grizzled, you know, looks like an ex-convict, shouldn't judge people and their appearances, but I mean, this guy had deep vein thrombosis on his forehead. He's weathered. He knocked about a bit. He's just a hard grizzled guy, but if I'm judging him right, and he is an ex-convict, there's one thing I know about convicts: they don't like to be recorded. So I have to keep pausing it. It's a lonely bloke on a bench I'm about to walk past. But yeah, it's I'll see you when you're out, mate, anyway. And the reason I just said that was because the lonely bloke on a bench, I didn't want him to mess with me. So I said, "I'll see you when you're out, mate," pretending that I'm talking to someone in prison as a defence. "See you when you're out, mate. Keep your nose clean in the meantime." I don't know. I was reading an article about Puritans. They said there's no such thing that actually exists as like a Puritan sect with their own church. They were just like industrious New Englanders or like English colonists who just so happened to be quite puritanical about things. They had strict ideas about everything. And he said they were just one half, rather than being called Puritans with a capital P, they were one half of a very difficult relationship. Much like my relationship with my ex. She was the Puritan, I was the cool guy. I was the what would it be, Calvinist? I was a cool ass Calvinist, mate. Just a guy who was like, "Yeah, I'll go with the flow." That's what Calvinists believe. They believe in predetermination. So whatever happens, whatever good deeds you do in life, whatever kind of ethical standards you keep to in your lived existence, it doesn't matter, mate. It's preordained. Do whatever the fuck you want. You're going to die a sinner if you were born a sinner, no matter what good you do in the world. But then if you do the good in the world, then they're like, "Well, that's one of the good ones. This was preordained that he was going to be a good lad." Whereas, I was all right. I was on pause in that relationship. Just sat in the lounge. That's what I did. And that was the extent of it. I sat in a lounge. It didn't feel like my own. That didn't feel like home. She really put the effort in. That's the thing. She was nesting. She wanted a nice house with someone she loved. And I wanted to be on the Red Nose Day broadcast. The extent of my comedy career. I was fucking Red Nose Day, featuring the Red Nose Day vox pop. I've got ideas bigger than this. I want to be fucking Red Nose Day. But no, it's a thought, you know. I've spoken about it before, but anyway. I've got ambition, love. I've got ambition. I want to be in one episode out of 8 out of 10 cats does countdown. I mean, one episode of that. I want to sell out half of my 50 allocated tickets. Half. I'm looking to 25, 26, 27. 27 people watching me live. in a cave with mildew heckling me. Yeah, Puritans, eh? I said, the thing is it's not a sustainable social vision if you're holding people to such severe account. If you're one of those killjoys, priggish and sexless. And when you're holding, that becomes an obsession, isn't it? Holding people to account as if you're an arbiter of virtue. Don't piss and moan when people decide to hold you to such high standards, you know, to such an exacting moral standards. It's not sustainable. You've got to make room for thought. Because that's the gristle of living, my friend. We all make mistakes. Oh yeah, we all make mistakes. So you should shout at football matches. So they're booing them when they're shit. When the defender does something wrong. Go, we all make mistakes. You're not infallible, mate. You're human. We all make mistakes. Errors are just part of it. You have value. We all make mistakes. But yeah. See you when you're out, mate. Yeah, keep your nose clean in the meantime. Just walk past a load of youths then, so they'll be scared. I don't know whether I look like a tough guy. Hard to kind of determine how you're seen by other people. I think since I shaved my head, I look a little bit more threatening. Don't want to look like that. I mean, I suppose I do to other men to a certain extent. Not nice blokes, but like so they're going to mess with you. I used to have to play the crazy card because, you know, I have a strong sense of justice. We all make mistakes. No, but I have a sense of justice. I don't want to bear witness to bullying, so I'd intervene. I was an interventionist, a non-humanitarian interventionist, because I fucking deck them. I would never start the fights. I'd never throw the punches first. But if it came to it, I would. I mean, they would give me a good hiding, really. But I could sustain it. I had a good pain threshold, you know. I could take a good beating, and knowing that I've tried my best to restore peace and to stop someone else getting in the neck. I remember the brilliant comedian Ahir Shah. He can vouch for me on this. He was getting hassled. Well, he says kind of gently hassled, but it's sad that he feels he has to play it down because he might get worse abuse. And that's horrible. It's really sad. And these guys are just like messing with him and started getting a bit more hostile. It's an undercurrent of threat to what they were saying. It stopped being banter, which is always the way, isn't it? It's always laced with a certain amount of animus with spite. And I saw it happening, I intervened, fucking squared up to the blokes. Well, like kind of said, hey, you nip that in the bud. And then one of them sort of went to me, this ain't your problem, mate. I went, well, it fucking is now. I've made it my problem, so. What's up, tough guy? Huh? I started clicking my fingers, going, ooh, we all make mistakes. but it stops that. I just don't like bullying. It's quite a self-evident thing to say, isn't it? Like, people go, I hate arrogance, I hate ignorance, and I hate bullying. It's usually quite people with a bit of a bullying tendency who say that. I've read a good thing, I'll have to read it out when I get home and do the at-home recall. Someone said about how the people who commit evil, like no one is committing evil, but framing it in their mind as, you know, kind of unbridled, unfettered evil. There's always part of them that'll see it as a virtuous act and that they're doing something right, they're on the right side of this. I don't know, don't think that's the case. I remember when I was young, and I write about it in the book actually, I told this kid, and it's when I broke off my best friend Louis for a year, you know, we've been friends since we were born, and I was part of the popular clique for the first time in my life, and your kind of social currency was whether you could come, or if you could make people laugh. For me, anyway, I wasn't a handsome one. And the way you made people laugh was caning each other off, holding your own in a battle of what Stuart Lee calls like the pathetic genius of teenage boys. Like, they can be quite blunt and forthright, and sometimes nothing will be funnier than, say, someone called in Captain Tom Moore a weak old cunt or something, just really blunt and to the point. So yeah, like them kids, like them ones, perfect example, once you're shouting, but they're having fun. And there's this boy who was quite au fait, he was quite catty, he was a gay kid, I imagine, lived around the corner from me. We both auditioned for the school play, one of my last foray into the theatre. Well, actually, there isn't, I'll tell you about that in a minute. And then, and we were down the park one day, and he'd kind of come over and he'd talk to us, and we'd sort of see him every now and again. And he told us about the fact that his sister just died. And I thought, just to be transgressive, just to be shocking, I thought I'd chip in and say, like, oh, I'm fucking glad your sister's dead. Still haunts me, it's awful. Luckily, they came down hard on me, my friends. They didn't reward that. I mean, they'd done a lot worse things than that I wasn't part of, because I just think I had more of a robust conscience in some ways, but obviously not in that moment. But even in that moment, as I said it, I thought, I know this is pure wrong. And I couldn't even justify it in my head. Like, this is just, that was just wrong. I could say, well, I needed to do it to you know, to kind of validate my position within the group in hierarchy and stop them from bullying me. So we'd kind of all supposed to bully each other in a way. And, but yeah, I didn't. I just, in the end, I just felt terrible. Went round his and played PlayStation with him, thinking my mum made him buy him like a box of chocolates as well. He's a little chubby cunt, he didn't need that, but so was I. We both had shaved head and were chubby. Maybe that's why I said it to him, because really I was saying it to myself. But yeah, I went and played PlayStation with him for a week, but too gay, way too gay for me. I'm joking, of course. I thought I was gay. Went for a stage, got wanked off by a boy. Snogged him and that. Don't know, it weren't for me. And he was a very bony boy. Like, the actual antithesis of, like, a woman. He was a skeleton. Sorry, just realised what I said there. It's like saying that women, little known fact about women is they have not got skeletons. You know, odd. You think people would talk about it more. I think it'd be common knowledge, wouldn't you, that women have no skeleton. But yeah, little known fact. Little known factoid. just getting too breathy. There's probably quite a lot of noise, pollution as well. Oh yeah, my second foray into the theatre, actually I had two. One was a work experience. I worked at, oh, what's it called now? We have a theatre in Southend called the Cliffs Pavilion, which is doing very well, and the Palace Theatre, which is doing very well, and then one that's like really shit, been there longer than anything else. They only basically do pantomimes. I worked there, and it was owned by a brother and sister. And the brother was like this lank-haired old sort of rocker who would always do like fart jokes and mug off his sister and mug her off about the fact she was barren and couldn't have kids. Piece of shit, yeah. But one day we were taking I was very insecure and so out of my depth. And one day we had to carry this mattress upstairs, and it was quite heavy, so sweat went into my eyes, so I was rubbing my eyes. And he went, shit. I was like, well, wait, no, not again. He went, Julie, that's his sister. He went, the work experience is crying again. I went, no, I'm not crying. I'm just going to imagine when you are crying. He's crying again. Julie, dude, we're not putting this down on the report. And then I got bullied by the bloke, the guy who played one of the women roles, a drag queen. And he said, oh, look, little Kurt Cobain grunger, is it? Kurt Cobain, don't remember. I think all the heroin knocked the fat out of him, no? Fucking catty bloke. And then I was a dementia consultant on a play by Tristan Bernays. But that is his name, I think. Tristan Bernays, called Old Fools. And then I just ended up working as like an administrative person as well. Like, I did some community outreach for it. Had sort of gateways into the old mad bollocks communities. It was a beautiful play. I really liked it. It was like really well staged. Just two people. Maybe, I mean, do you know what? Actually, there was a chance it could teeter into sentimentality, as is always the way with these things. It's been a bit maudlin. But it didn't, not from my memory anyway. I remember it might have just towed that line, but it never quite made the leap. But then a lot of these stories are like the thing I like about the people I've cared for anyway is how unexceptional some of them are. Like, there's a woman who worked in a flower bag in factories. Giving her a joke, she had some banging flower stories. But then, like, my mum's recently worked with someone who was a sniper in the Congo. Portuguese fella, sniper in the Congo. Ended up assaulting my mum recently. He's got dementia, poor guy. It's not his fault, but it's... he's not able to acknowledge that anything's wrong with him, because he's at that liminal stage, that threshold where he has enough cognizance to be in the world, to be in the actual world, and then but enough of his brain has fallen away, which isn't the actual science of addiction, by the way. He's mushed off, he's broken off, a bit of wet cake. He is demented as well, but sad. I'll do a little bit more recording while walking, otherwise it gets boring if you ain't got anything to listen to. Someone just looked at me as if I was mad. It's modern technology. We should be over this now. It shouldn't be weird seeing people walking along talking to themselves with their knobs out. Ha 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 ha. Low hanging fruit. That's what I call my knob. But yeah, I've been writing about death. I've been writing about death recently. It's got some good bits in it. How death-centered and funereal my relationship with Mari, who you heard talking on the first ever episode of this podcast, pre-death. But I realised how when kind of an integral part of that, of part of our relationship was this focus, this inordinate focus on the inevitable fade, on death. And she would talk about it in this kind of lilting sing-song way that was quite childlike and inquisitive, struggling with comprehension, trying to understand it all. Very Buddhist, very Zen, looking at the whole life. And the, you know, we're looking at eternity after death as something that isn't a mystery. So when you think of, when you think of life in Buddhism, you think of life and death. I think that's why they scatter their dead along the hillside. I don't know if that's a myth or not, but it's to demonstrate, you know, how comfortable they are with it, how comfortable they are with a load of dead bodies slung over a hillside. But so it's weird with this relationship, because she'd always ask things like, am I dead? Am I dying? Am I dead? What does hell look like? Am I in hell? And then the real curveball, which was, do I have to eat my dinner with Hitler when I'm in heaven? And sort of judging by that question, she obviously understands heaven as something quite quotidian, something quite provincial. You know, eating dinner, as like golf clubs and women's institutes, and getting sozzled in village halls, eating dinner, day for the carpets and curtains. That's what how she envisages heaven. But, and it still has the same provisional seating arrangements, a fraught provisional seating arrangements, as she's used to in the care home, where there's some people who still keep the same seats, but others who, you know, bit trial and error, can they sit together with the mood she's in at the moment? Do I have to move her over there? Because that's what Mari's concerned with. She's concerned with the dinner arrangements in heaven and Hitler, apparently. And you imagine Hitler sort of tackling a poached pear, bit falling off his spoon, goes in for the next one, same thing happens. He pushes the pear aside, slams down his spoon on the table, folds his arms, and when a carer approaches to offer help, he goes, nein, quietly but passive aggressively, nein, and stews and sulks and seethes. But it's, I mean, for her, it might be something to do with the fact that, you know, the fumes of Nazism, affected everyone in World War II. But for someone who was married to a German, it must have been especially carcinogenic. And you can only, I've only managed, she's offered fragments of memory about her husband. She hasn't got any photos of them together. They were married for a long time. She clearly loved him, from what we can tell. and someone particularly brazen care worker once said, went up to her and said, like, and said, "Oh, was your husband a Nazi?" And Mari replied, "Of course not, dear. Like, you fight for the country, not the party." And I thought, I don't know if that's necessarily true under a dictatorship. It's not like over here, you know, you don't have to be in the army to be a conservative, even though the armed forces usually lean conservative, because you're conserving British state values. I suppose the army and any kind of humanitarian intervention is to either force that on other countries or preserve it in other countries that have turned over to a very tentative democratic situation. But yeah, it's always been there's been a kind of spectre that's hovered in the background of our companionship. Like, is her husband a friend of Goebbels? Does that make her a collaborationist? She said he wasn't a Nazi, but she said he was a prisoner. This is all going by her statements, and remember that she is someone who had a lot of clarity in her thinking in some ways, but also had dementia, and by the very nature of that disease, she'd be an unreliable narrator. I never confirmed it to family. I mean, by her surname and by some offhand kind of idle recollections from her daughter, the husband was in fact German. But yes, it's an uncomfortable, awkward area of inquiry, isn't it? And I'll never, you're dad a Nazi? I vaguely remember, actually I'm pretty almost positive, but I can't, I mean, you never know with memory, do you? But I remember saying he was part of the Hitler Youth, but obviously with that there's a lot of indoctrination, you know, they're children, they don't understand. And would there have been a lot of propaganda protecting unwilling to disclose the full scale of their country and their government's horrors, atrocities. So, I mean, with us as well, look at the horrors, the evil, the pure evil of the English Empire, stuff that was still going on in the 1950s, concentration camps and stuff in Africa, probably elsewhere as well. We're protected from knowing the full extent of that, don't we, aren't we? I don't think there's ever complete candor. And it's a weird, a thing I said online where I said, I don't know what I'll read it out from where I get something I wrote the other day about this, like, idea of British pride. You don't. I just walked past a guy who looked like he had a lot of British pride going by. I go by the redness of the neck. That's a good gauge. I said the other day, in order to promote pride of a particular country, or a particular ethnicity or sexual orientation is because that is a country of sexual orientation or ethnicity or whatever that is has a kind of lesser place societally, has a lesser place in society, and Britain is not an underdog in any way, really. So there's no need to restore balance and make sure it's getting the recognition it deserves, because it already has it. Anyway, I'm back home now, so I'll end this week's podcast there. It's quite a long one, long I walk. I'll make sure I record it in my room next time. I know the noise bleed can be a bit annoying. But yeah, hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Love to you all.